I'm Michael Brown. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is reported as saying during his summit on Thursday with Russian President Vladimir Putin that peace and security on the Korean Peninsula depend entirely on the future of U.S. attitude. North Korean state media said Friday that Kim said the situation on the Korean Peninsula and the region is now at a standstill and has reached a critical point where it may return to its original state as the U.S. took a unilateral attitude and bad faith at the recent second North Korea-U.S. summit talks. No deal was reached in February at the Hanoi summit between Kim and President Trump, and the U.S. has refused to meet Kim's request to ease sanctions before he shows the United States he is ending his nuclear program. The human rights group Amnesty International says U.S. coalition forces killed more than 1,600 civilians in an air campaign to retake the city of Raqqa from the Islamic State. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the figure is 10 times more than acknowledged by the coalition officials.
The coalition offensive to retake the Islamic State's self-declared capital of Raqqa began in June 2017. Over the course of 5 months, Amnesty claims the operation took more than 1,600 civilian lives. Following a two-year investigation, the group says it has gathered names for more than 1,000 of the victims and says it has verified 641 deaths on the ground in Raqqa. In response to the evidence it has presented, Amnesty says coalition forces have acknowledged far fewer civilian deaths. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
As always, if you'd like to join us for more news, you can visit our website, that is voanews.com or the mobile VOA app. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. U.S. President Donald Trump is denying that he ordered White House counsel Donald McGahn to fire special counsel Robert Mueller to thwart Mueller's investigation into the Trump campaign's links to Russia in the 2016 election. In his 448-page report released a week ago, Mueller said that Trump called McGahn twice and directed him to fire Mueller, but he did not follow the order and later resigned. Mueller concluded that neither Trump nor his campaign could be charged with conspiring with the Russians to help him defeat the Democratic challenger Hillary Clinton, despite numerous contacts with Russian operatives. The prosecutor, however, cited several possible obstruction of justice by Trump, but reached no conclusion, leaving that up to Congress to determine. North Korea is reported to be billing the United States $2 million for medical care of a U.S. college student who was detained in Pyongyang in 2016 and returned to the U.S. comatose more than a year later. Sources tell the Washington Post the U.S. envoy sent to retrieve the unresponsive Otto Wambier signed an agreement to pay the medical bill at the direction of President Trump. The bill went to the Treasury Department, but it was not clear whether the administration paid the invoice. Wambier was detained in 2016 for allegedly stealing a banner in a North Korean hotel. Tens of thousands of people marched in Sudan's capital Thursday for what organizers called a million-strong march in support of civilian rule just weeks after Omar al-Bashir was ousted from power. Nabama Haydeen reports from Khartoum.
Tens of thousands of Sudanese poured onto Khartoum's streets Thursday, calling for military leaders who toppled Omar al-Bashir to hand over power to civilian leaders. Sudan's main protest group, the Sudanese Professionals Association, organized the march after talks with the Transitional Military Council deadlocked. Three members of the TMC resigned late Wednesday after the SPA called for the march. The military ousted Bashir on April 11 after 3 decades in power and 4 months of anti-government protests. Military leaders took over, promising elections within 2 years. But protesters are demanding immediate civilian rule and have refused to leave the streets. Naba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
The U.S. Embassy in Colombia is advising people to avoid places of worship in Sri Lanka over the coming weekend, citing the Sri Lankan reports that additional attacks may occur. The warning comes after a devastating attack on Christian worshipers on Easter Sunday when suicide bombers killed more than 250 people. Authorities revised the number from more than 350, saying that some of the bodies may have been counted twice. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 26th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Zambia's main opposition party says it will not participate in the ongoing National Dialogue Forum.
The United Party for National Government have decided not to participate in the National Dialogue Forum because we think that it is a sham.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition UPND party. We'll examine the implications of Senegalese President Macky Sall's decision to abolish the position of prime minister. We'll also look at feminism in the African context. A Pan-African conference is being held in Kenya to create awareness about autism, and the Democratic Republic of Congo has elected its first woman speaker of parliament.
My reaction is good because it is the first time to have a woman, Mrs. Jeanine Mabunda, as the chief of this parliament.
Paul Nsapu is the DRC human rights activist, and Zimbabwe records nearly 60% decline in malaria-related deaths since 2015. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND, says it will not participate in the national dialogue currently going on in Lusaka, saying the composition of the dialogue is biased in favor of President Edgar Lungu and his ruling Patriotic Front Party. President Lungu officially opened the talks yesterday, Thursday, at the Mulungushi International Conference Center in Lusaka. It will review suggestions from Zambians for amending the draft constitution. Participants include civil society groups, state institutions, legal bodies, and individuals. Charles Kokoman is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition, UPND.
The United Party for National Development have decided not to participate in the National Dialogue Forum, which has been created by the ruling party, the Republican President Edgar Lungu, because we think that it is a sham. We had originally agreed as stakeholders that this national dialogue process should be led by the church. But President Lungu changed the purpose and created his own dialogue forum, which is led by his ruling party, and has appointed the chairman of that forum, who is sympathetic to him.
But Charles, isn't this the reason why the UPND has to be present in order to register your protest or to push back, so Zambians and the world at large will know your position rather than stay back? Because this is an important review of the constitution that will be implemented in Zambia.
The composition of that forum is skewed towards the ruling party. They've brought their own government officials that are answerable to the president. They cannot speak against what the president wants. They've brought surrogate political parties, they've brought surrogate NGOs, and so on. Our voice there will just be going there to make noise, but when it comes to voting, it's predetermined. They have an inbuilt majority, and they'll be passing what they want.
So what is your alternative to addressing this particular constitutional amendment, which will be under discussion during this national dialogue?
Our approach is that this thing must be stopped. We must come back to where we were, that there must be consensus built and go back to the church-led dialogue process. That is the only one that will bring credibility to what we are going to discuss. Otherwise, we, the large political parties, have boycotted. The major churches in Zambia, including the Catholic Church and other bigger churches, have boycotted. A lot of credible NGOs have boycotted because it's a sham.
Some Zambians are saying the UPND, as usual, is playing politics when it has to be serious about the serious national consideration, such as the constitution, which is under review. Now, the president is going to sign it into law, and that will affect every Tom, Dick, and Harry in the UPND, as well as the Patriotic Front or the ruling party. What is your next line of action that will positively impact this process?
Well, it is moving ahead, and if they come up with a flawed process, it's not going to succeed. We saw it the other time when they tried to introduce a new Bill of Rights through referendum without consulting anybody, and it flopped. And as a result, they don't have that new Bill of Rights.
Charles Kakoman is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition, UPND. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. The Democratic Republic of Congo has elected its first woman Speaker of Parliament. She is Jeannie Mabunda, a member of former President Joseph Kabila's Common Forum for Congo Coalition, which holds the majority of seats in the 500-member parliament. Mabunda also got the backing of President Felix Tshisekedi's ruling coalition. The main opposition, Lamuka Coalition, boycotted the process, citing political maneuvering. The next step now is the nomination of a prime minister. Paul Nsapu is a DRC human rights activist. He says he welcomes the election of the first woman Speaker of Parliament, but he says more needs to be done to make up for the disparity in women representation in Parliament and other governmental institutions.
My reaction is good because it is the first time to have a woman, Mrs. Jeannie Mabunda, as the chief of this parliament. It is in our story in DRC the first time. But for us, it is not sufficient because the balance of the gender in our institution is not very good. Because women, but it is a good step to have women as the chief of parliament in DRC.
During the process, the main opposition, Lamuka, which is headed by Martin Fayulu, did not participate. What do you make of that?
We, as civil society, we must see things in a good way. We, the civil society, will put pressure on this parliament to work normally for the will of people of Congo.
The next thing that the parliament has to do is that they have to pick a prime minister. Is the prime minister going to come from the same Kabila coalition?
You know that this election at the level of parliament, it was not very good. I think it will be very good to have somebody who come from civil society so that things can be in a good way to have a good government in DRC.
You said that you hope that all the parties will work with the new Speaker of the Parliament, Ms. Mabunda. What do you make of Mr. Fayulu from Lamuka, who still believes that he won the election? Do you think that it is time now for everybody to come together?
Yeah, I think that it is the moment for everybody to work with these women and this parliament. But I think that thing will go on. We must push again the pressure to have good work for this parliament according to the will of the population of DRC.
Paul Nsapu is a DRC human rights activist. He was speaking with me from Paris, France. Senegalese President Macky Sall surprised the public this month when he announced the elimination of the position of Prime Minister. Giles Yabi, a political analyst and founder of Wati Think Tank, spoke with Ricky Stryak about what this means for President Sall's power and future democratic governance in Senegal.
I think the first thing is the fact that this came as a surprise. There was an electoral campaign in Senegal, and at any moment, President Macky Sall made it clear that he wanted to make a significant institutional change. So this really came as a surprise after his re-election, and I think that gives some wrong signal about the fact that on these important institutional issues, he considers that he can make a decision basically without discussing it and without actually letting the population know about it.
Does it consolidate Sall's power? And if so, how?
I'm not sure that it will change a lot in the reality of how the power is exercised in Senegal. Even with the prime minister, the power, as the executive power, has always been in the hand of the president. The only difference in the situation where the president does not control the majority in the parliament. but that situation is quite unlikely. So in the reality, I'm not sure that the fact that we are not going to have a prime minister is going to change a lot in terms of who really has the power. And the prime minister has never been a very significant political figure in Senegal.
The administration stated their goal was to speed up the reforms, to kind of lose some of that bureaucratic baggage. And I think it is an interesting discussion to talk about the government infrastructure and how it's a holdover from colonialism. And perhaps, everyone complains about the bureaucracy of the government. And now that Sall has tried to get rid of some of that, could this speed up reforms?
Well, that is, the kind of official reason for that is to try to streamline the government procedures and to speed up the reforms, especially as this is the last mandate of the president. I think it is acceptable as a reason, but I'm not sure that the problem is suppressing the position of the prime minister. I think that we tend, and it's not only Senegal, but a lot of countries in the region tend to find kind of very quick institutional responses to problems of the quality of administration and the functioning of the government. I think that the problem is not just suppressing one position. The problem is making sure that there are consistent reforms in the public administration more generally and make more consistent institutional reforms, not just suppressing the position of prime minister.
That was Giles Yabi, political analyst and founder of Wati Think Tank. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Senegal's capital, Dakar. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 26. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. Autism in most African countries is viewed as a curse, and autistic children and adults are often neglected. A Pan-African Congress on Autism enters its second day today in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the conference held is creating awareness about autism that experts say has been on the rise in Africa.
Autism is a development disorder that affects the communication and behavior of human beings in most cases. The condition can be discovered between the age of 18 months to 3 years. According to the Center for Disease Control, CDC, autism is four times more common in boys than girls. Ruth Tenai, a Kenyan living in the United States, is a mother of 10-year autistic boy and also founder of Step Up for Autism Foundation in Kenya. She narrates her encounter with the condition that some of the family members are not accepting. She says most parents do not accept their children and autism is viewed as a curse.
Everybody was asking what happened to him, you know, like something is wrong with him, you know, but even if you try to tell them it's autism, they still don't understand that. The accepting part was the most difficult because not everybody is conversant with autism.
Doctors have not found the cause of autism, and now the scientific application is the only cause being applied in the medical field, whereby doctors say it might be a genetic disorder. Karen Muriuki is an autistic adult. She says that her condition when she was young was not well received by the family, and at times she did not get the special care. Ms. Muriuki could not manage to get the required education for fear of discrimination in school, and she still lives with her parents.
The reception that I got from teachers were in and out, up and down. Sometimes teachers can be very hostile, and even at some point, even the students there were not very friendly, so I ended up being bullied. But there were some students who are more understanding, even though they didn't know that I was autistic. I've learned how to take things very positively.
Many African countries are now coming up with foundations to create awareness for people who are autistic. Susan Gagwavu, founder of the New Life Autism Foundation in Uganda, says stigmatization has been the reason most parents are not standing up for their children. She says the government should come up with a curriculum for the autistic persons.
As a Ugandan representative, I'm really calling upon the government of Uganda to get involved, because we have tried everything by ourselves, parents, therapists, doctors, but without government getting involved, we can't do much. As we speak right now, there's no curriculum in the country for these children.
In Rwanda, the African beliefs of autism is witchcraft and curse in the society has applied to the discrimination and stigmatization of autistic persons. Clementine Uitonze, a founder of Birashawoka Dufa Tanyinje Organization for Autistic Persons, says she has embarked on talent nurturing for the children who are autistic.
Many people, they don't think that those kids are able. Having children living with disability doesn't mean that they are not able. They are able as long as you know how to communicate with them, and they are very talented. So challenges is to find places where we can give them a special education.
Autism is a condition that can be managed if the autistic persons are well taken care of. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Feminism has been defined as the theory of the political, economic, and social equality of the sexes, an organized activity on behalf of women's rights and interests. But the idea of feminism can vary depending on where you live. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo looks into what feminism means for Africans.
From Nairobi to Conakry, women across Africa are demanding change in attitudes towards sexual harassment, fair wages, access to land, and equal opportunities for political leadership. But they're doing it in their own way, says Gwendolyn Michael, professor of anthropology and foreign service at Georgetown University and author of a book on African feminism.
In the U.S., women often think feminism means I alone determine what's best for me. But African feminism is very much a different thing. It's about how women interpret their interests and empowerment within the context of where they live and their cultural values.
Feminism has historically had negative connotations on the African continent, says Shingirai Matera, who teaches African feminist theory at Rhodes University in South Africa.
Feminism, one, is considered to be a title that is given to middle-class people or people who are white. There's also an attachment to feminism that feminism is anti-men and anti-African cultural systems and anti-African traditional practices.
Advocating for women's rights on the basis of equality of the sexes can be intimidating for some men, but American University professor Kweku Nwama says it shouldn't be the case.
And it starts with not being afraid of the word feminist, and understanding that what's right for our women is right for us as a society, as a continent in general.
He says some of the problems require a shift in cultural attitudes, and those take a long time. But some countries aren't waiting. Rwanda, for example, has the largest share of seats in parliament in the world held by women.
Rwanda is a terrific example of what public policy can do to help women. They use quotas. Then on the other end of the spectrum, you see countries like Tanzania, where the government says you can't go to school if you're pregnant.
Dr. Michael says things are evolving on the continent. People like Kenya's environmental political activist Wangari Maathai and South Africa's anti-apartheid activist Winnie Mandela are seen as great feminist inspirations for Matera. But is being a feminist critical in the empowerment of women in general?
The simple answer for that would be no, because many women across the decades have done work that is what we would consider to be feminist.
She says the lack of the feminism label in some cases doesn't negate the credibility of their work. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Authorities in Zimbabwe say the country has recorded a close to 60% decline in malaria-related deaths since 2015. At the same time, the country saw a 25% increase in reported cases in Manicaland.
Malaria cases in Zimbabwe, they continue to go down in terms of morbidity or the number of illnesses. So we seem to be making a big progress towards our goal of realizing malaria elimination in the country and, of course, working with our neighbors in the region. So, yeah, we have seen some significant decline. Probably, I would put it at a 57% decline since 2015 so far. Of course, the gains are fragile because of the sensitivity of the environment that promotes breeding of mosquitoes, especially the recent events of the cyclone. Cyclone Idai, we promoted the breeding grounds more because there was more rain, destruction of homes, which we sprayed, thereby exposing people to more mosquito bites and malaria, as it is. So those are the threats that we have to live with from time to time. But Overall, yes, we've seen some significant improvement.
You talked about the effects of Cyclone Idai and the issue of malaria in the affected area, which is Manicaland. Did you witness an uptick there?
Yes, we are in the peak period of transmission, so we've also seen about 25% increase in the disease burden ever since the cyclone hit Manicaland from the 15th of March to date, compared to the same period last year. And we believe that is definitely due to the increased risks that were posed by the cyclone when the people's homes were destroyed.
That was Zimbabwe National Malaria Coordinator Dr. Joseph Mbare Kunashi speaking from Manicaland with Blessing Zulu of View Zimbabwe's service. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with the CAF Champions League semi-final fixtures this weekend, which will have an all-star cast of the last four winners. TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa, Wydad Casablanca of Morocco, and Esperance of Tunisia. Wydad will face Sundowns in Rabat today, while Esperance will meet TP Mazembe in Raids on Saturday, and both second legs are scheduled for next week Saturday. It is the first time since the Premier Club African Cup competition debuted 55 years ago that the penultimate phase has featured the last four champions. Trophy holders Esperance of Tunisia are on a five-match Champions League winning streak, while TP Mazembe from the Democratic Republic of Congo have gone six games unbeaten. Wydad Casablanca of Morocco have been inconsistent, failing to win successive CAF matches even once, while Mamelodi Sundowns from South Africa won two and lost two of their last four outings. Should Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa and TP Mazembe of Democratic Republic of Congo qualify for the finals, it will be the first title decider since 2009 not to feature at least one North African club. Staying with CAF organized competition, but this time in Tanzania, Guinea under-17 football team has made history by knocking out tournament favorite Nigeria from the finals of the under-17 African Cup of Nations in Dar es Salaam. Cameroon also edged out Angola. What this means is that the Silly Cadets of Guinea will face Cameroon in the final after both won their semifinals on penalties. Guinea were 10-9 winners over Nigeria in a tense shootout after Nigeria's David Oduko Ogaga missed his spot kick at the National Stadium in Dar es Salaam. Garba Manu is Nigeria's Golden Eagles chief coach.
We lost gallantly, despite the fact that the Guineans were bigger than my boys. They had their physical presence to intimidate some of the players. Of course, they had the protection of the center mark certain times. But I must say that we gave a good account of ourselves. We created more chances than the Malians. We are just unlucky not to wrap up the game for regulation time.
10-man Cameroon beat Angola 4-3 on penalties after their match had also finished 0-0 in normal time. Pedro Gonzalez is the Angola under-17 team coach.
I think we did a smart match, missed the opportunities we create, and this is football, and not more about that.
All four semi-finalists have qualified to represent Africa at the under-17 FIFA World Cup to take place in Brazil in November. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, April 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Butt in Washington wishing you a very good weekend.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. Believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.